This is the November 23 edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Today we'll talk with Ben Brown, agricultural economist from the University of Illinois, and then we'll turn our attention to the banking system. We'll discuss what Compeer Financial does. It's part of the farm credit system that operates across the nation, and we'll discuss a startup that has a different way to make production loans to farmers. Commodity Week, of course, is a production of Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world. Find us online at willag.org. That's willag.org. Ben Brown now joins us from University of Missouri Extension and FAPRI, the Food and Agricultural Policy Research Institute. Hi, Ben. Thank you for being with us today on this Friday. I do appreciate that. Now, you and I, of course, are recording on Wednesday, so things may have changed at the CME Group in Chicago, but it's pretty unlikely on the things we're about to talk about. I want to talk about logistics, maybe supply and demand tables, but let's begin with just straight up logistics. I think there are a couple of things we're concerned about in the United States, Mississippi River and railway, potential strike still.
Absolutely, yep. And so we're seeing that low water levels, even though they've improved some, have increased transportation costs across the river. That, again, I always want to make the clarification, it is split evenly between the buyer, or not evenly, it is split between the buyers and the sellers. It's always split. Sometimes, the buyer might be paying more, the seller might be paying more, but it's always split. And it really depends on that push and pull factor. Is grain trying to be pushed into the system? If that's the case, then those buyers or the sellers tend to pay a little bit more of the cost. If it's grain that's trying to be pulled into the system, then the sellers are going to pay more of that cost. So we are seeing increased transportation costs. At the moment, I would say that the sellers are paying a little bit more of that transportation cost than what the sellers are. And we're seeing that in basis bids, right? Basis bids haven't fallen near as hard in some cases as what many people would anticipate with higher transportation costs. And that's because that's being absorbed at the end point where the sellers are paying for that price. So we're seeing that. However, due to those logistics issues on the river, we are seeing grain and volume spill over into railways. That's causing those secondary markets to remain elevated. And probably giving a little bit more, political power or clout, if you will, to railways as they continue to work through negotiations that are set to end here on December 8th. So just last week or at the end of last week, news of the second largest railway union rejecting the negotiated deal from a couple months ago. I do anticipate a deal will get struck at some point in time, but in terms of what that looks like and how close we are to that deadline is still yet to be determined. So.
As it relates to logistics and the river, is there very much concern on your part about the lagging corn exports and or soybeans needing to move down the river? And the time of year we are in, usually we get to move things fairly quickly out of this part of the world, at least soybeans, in the end of the calendar year, and then we switch to corn. But it all has to move southward at some point, and the rivers are likely to freeze north of St. Louis. How much of a problem or issue does this create for the export market?
Yeah, absolutely. So you've mentioned or you've outlined everything I would put into this block except for one. And I'd add one other big concern that's kind of out there that I think is going to tap into our export window, if you will. And that's what I'm going to call this is our main export window when we have grain that's plentiful, when we're competing very strongly in the world market. And then as you correctly mentioned, we get to a certain point in January and February when our products become less competitive because there's product elsewhere in the world and we lose some of that, that market share. So you correctly identified that. Transportation certainly plays a big role in all this. And you certainly want it to happen in times when we're not in our export window. It just happens this year. All this is happening within our export window, and that's continuing to cause us concern in getting product out. Everybody was surprised in early November when USDA did not adjust those export targets for corn and soybeans. And, you know, you look out and it's a long ways to go till the end of the marketing year next August, but certainly, you know, we're on a path of not being able to hit those targets, because here pretty quickly in the next couple of months, our competitors are going to come onto the market, and it's going to happen in both corn and soybeans. The most notable one is always soybeans, because, you know, Brazil is such a large producer. South America is such a large producer of soybeans. However, there is trade relations forming between China and South America, Brazil in particular, for corn. We saw the first cargo loads of corn heading out this week, and that's going to continue to increase over the years to come. So again, we're talking about, this is our primary export window, and we're having challenges during our primary export window on logistics. Let me add in the one thing that I think you forgot to miss, or that you forgot, or maybe you didn't know about, but I would add in as a big thing this year, is Argentina re-upping their pesos, or soybeans for pesos program. This was a program that we saw back in the early part of the marketing year, August and September, where the Argentina government was trying to get Argentina producers to bring soybeans to the market so they could export, and they paid them a very high price for those soybeans. Right now, there's chatter about renewing that here in November and December. That would bring a good chunk of soybeans, a large amount of soybeans to the market at a point where this is our export window. And again, like, you're bringing soybeans, a competitor is bringing soybeans to the market that would chap into our market share. That brings me great concern as well. So logistics and the possibility of soybean availability elsewhere in the world potentially really starts to tap into our exports.
So farmers will remember this. This was an issue for the United States somewhat, because it's outside of our export window, but during the summer months, and this soybeans for peso program in Argentina really did a number on availability of the export market for U.S. producers.
Well, it really stopped. Yes, you are correct, Todd. You are very correct. What it did is it delayed purchases or the need of soybeans out of the Chinese market for maybe a month. Let's just say a month and a half beyond what they usually, you know, start needing U.S. soybeans. So it built up their supplies. They were able to, you know, delay export purchases for a period of time. And we certainly saw that as in those early season export sales volumes, just not at the targets we had normally been seeing them. And again, it comes back to, there was relative supply in the world that was able to fill that need in the short term. So even though it happened during the summer months, it delayed some of those early sales, early purchases that we're normally seeing. Again, this time it's maybe not delaying, you know, it's not eating into our you know, later sales, our deferred sales. It could immediately impact our current sales if it were to come on board and we start seeing, you know, lower volumes moving in December, January, and possibly even into February, that time period. So eating into our export window, that's my main theme here, Todd, is like, we've got major challenges that are making it hard for us to move product during our period that we own and that is ours. We've got challenges, and it's going to be hard for us to reach those export targets if these all materialize in the next 2 months. We're going to know in 2 months whether we've got a serious situation.
You're not painting a very pretty picture for corn or soybean prices going forward.
You know, so again, it comes down to managing this risk. My colleague Scott Brown here at the University of Missouri, who does our livestock markets, I've been very impressed with how he's been handling cattle markets. And I know, you know, we're not talking about cattle markets today, but if you only look at the supply side of cattle, and I'm going to bring this back to corn and soybeans, but if you only look at the supply side of cattle, you know, it is a very rosy picture. There is lots of reasons to get very excited about cattle prices moving forward. But Scott talks about the demand, and he says you have to incorporate the demand, because, you know, there's this concern that, you know, money is starting to slow down, that people aren't, you know, spending as much on meats, and the threat of a recession hitting really starts to tamper some of those expectations for higher prices. I would say the exact same thing on corn and soybeans. If you only look at the supply of corn and soybeans, there is reason to be optimistic about corn and soybean prices. But if you take into account demand, and some of these things we're talking about in the export market, you know, you could look at the ethanol market if we were to have a recession that severely reduced gasoline usage over the next year, right? Like, there are some demand softening fundamentals that really kind of start to taper those expectations of higher prices. And that's what I'm talking about, right? It's like, you have to take them both into account to get a full picture here.
So we have a relatively short supply of soybeans, certainly a short supply domestically of corn in this country. Demand, we've already talked about being limited both by competition from Brazil and logistics in the United States. What other demand issues do you see?
Well, so that's really the big one. I would say, you know, the ethanol one, if a significant recession were to hit at a point where we had already set those blending targets, and we reduced miles driven per person here in the United States, you know, that would bring me concern. Also in terms of demand for products. But let me tell you about something I am excited about, or, you know, that I think is strong, is, you know, feed use for corn is going to continue to remain a very solid demand driver moving forward. The reason is lack of competition. When we think about those feed grains, you're looking at grain sorghum, very short crop of grain sorghum, because it's grown in Kansas and Oklahoma, states that took the biggest hit during the drought. Another feed grain, wheat. We tend to see wheat work its way into the feed bunks when it becomes cost competitive. You know, that's not going to happen because, again, here in the U.S. where that happens, that winter wheat crop came in the southern plains, very drought stricken. Plus, we've got all the other challenges globally in the wheat market that are keeping that kind of cost prohibited to competing against corn. So corn as a feed use is going to continue to remain very strong. I would say the same thing about soybean meal. The potential for soybean meal to be, you know, a kind of a demand holder, if you will, something that's going to continue to be there on the soybean market is that soybean meal component. There's all the excitement around soybean oil potentially coming on, causing a glut of soybean meal. At least in the short term, the soybean meal complex seems to be well supported. And we'll hang in there to kind of help keep those soybean values a little bit, you know, kind of put a little bit of floor underneath them, if you will. But yes, those are the other demand categories out there that I can get kind of relatively stable on. It's the export market that I think we're all sitting here going, wow, you know, this could turn very south very quickly.
What does it mean for price going forward in this case? How do you balance the two? Because the supply and demand tables, you're going to have to adjust, it appears.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been using the phrase, this is like Groundhog Day, that movie that, you know, the guy wakes up and it's the same thing every day. You know, I'm seeing a lot of these same things that we're talking about today. We probably, you know, I was at least talking about a year ago. And we were talking about, you know, the potential for a large South American crop coming on board, helping weigh on global prices. The potential for a, you know, tightness, if you will, in the U.S. supply crop when it came around. And we got that, right? And those would all, you know, signal, or like, you know, my parallel here between this year and last year is that I would have anticipated prices to fall into this fall compared to what they were last year if I was doing this interview with you a year ago. That's what I was anticipating because I expected that there would be growth and production globally. We didn't get that. We also had a conflict in Ukraine pop up, right? So we didn't get that. However, like I'm going to sit here and say that I anticipate prices to move lower as we move our way through the year. On the futures market, basis bids, depending on where you're at in the country, could even strengthen, could strengthen and get larger, kind of creating some offsetting price signals or, you know, a relatively stable cash price for producers as we look ahead. But there's going to be opportunities to price higher price grain. That's if you're a corn and soybean producer and you're saying, hey, when do I sell? There's going to be opportunities, but I would encourage you not to miss them, to be, you know, cognizant of what's happening, the timing, the seasonality. All that said and done, you know, if we end up with another short crop in South America, if it gets really warm in Argentina, like it's projected here over the next couple of weeks, if Brazil has another short crop, again, this year that we, you know, aren't anticipating at this point, but it really didn't come on as a short crop until January. That's how long it took for us to realize, hey, there's some challenges in South America for soybean production. You know, if those were to materialize, you know, we're tight in global markets and we could see these prices move even higher. But standing here in November right now, it's hard to see, you know, a supply shortfall coming. I mean, we just don't know. We don't have enough data. It's not close enough to the production season. So right now we're basically looking at, okay, let's assume a decent supply and then talk about demand. And that's where it gets a little soft. That's where it's a little negative. But we'll have a much better picture come later December or even in early January.
So pick your price, make the sale for old crop, what does it mean for new crop corn and soybeans?
Yeah, so, you know, we talk a lot about carry in the market. You know, the market is telling us when and, you know, when to store, when not to store. You know, that's something that always comes up. And we can do the math and take into account, you know, basis valuations and stuff like that. I think my point for many people is, or, you know, like at least in terms of marketing strategies is, you know, we're getting a good price and the market's really not giving as much incentive to store, if any. And so, you know, if you want to protect some of that, you know, upward price potential, you know, this is maybe the opportunity where you take out a call and, you know, you just go ahead and bank on, okay, I'm hoping, you know, even if that call were to expire worthless, you know, I'm out the premium cost for that call. Am I okay with that, right? You're reducing that per bushel on what you've already sold. But, you know, basically what that's giving you is the opportunity to participate if the market goes up. And you know, this might be the scenario for that. This would be a year where that would be, if, you know, potentially in play. It just, you know, it comes down to, do you want to mess with it? Some people don't want to mess with that, don't want to enter into futures and options because it's one more thing to manage and take care of and work on paperwork and stuff. But that's a possibility.
Anything else before I let you go?
I think that's all I got. Happy holiday week to you, Todd, and see you in a month.
Indeed we will. Ben Brown is an agricultural economist with FAPRI, the Food and Agricultural Policy Research Institute, and University of Missouri Extension. The rest of the time today, we'll talk about the banking system as it relates to agriculture. Of course, many producers are familiar with the farm credit system across the whole of the nation. In the state of Illinois, that is split between the northern and the southern half. The southern half is Farm Credit Illinois, and the northern half is Compeer Financial. John Munson from Compeer was at the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Convention, and I asked him to explain to me what exactly the system does.
So we lend to farmers. We provide crop insurance as well. We have a whole list of other services that we do. But that's really core to what we do is focus on farm financing, crop insurance. We support also rural communities as well. So I oversee our marketing team and oversee our corporate giving, all of our government affairs work in some other areas as well, including investing in rural communities.
What concerns do you have this winter as it's related to farm lending programs, whether that be for very high-priced land at this time, and it continues to go up, or for the production loans that are made each and every year?
Input side is really what we're concerned about, I think, the most. There's a lot of volatility, as you know. I mean, who can predict what's going to happen with China? Who can predict what's going to happen in Ukraine? Who can predict exactly what will happen with interest rates and inflation? All of it's a little variable, and I think we're going to see some volatility in the markets as well. It all ends up meaning that we have to pay more attention, especially to the input side of our operations. So I think that's the key. If you haven't looked at that as carefully in the past, that it, you know, you just take it as it comes, I would encourage people to get a little more intentional about evaluating locking in prices earlier around the input side. I think that's really one of the big keys as we look at the next upcoming crop season and making sure that we're really being smart about looking at our operations.
Because the system also sells crop insurance during the growing season, they do take some stances, the system that is, on marketing issues that are related to farmers. So if prices are really high in the middle of the growing season, they might say, you know, we protected this crop and you can sell more of it because you're protected if you've purchased crop insurance. You mentioned the input side and risk management there. Are there issues that Compeer and the Farm Credit System have been talking about as related to what producers should do to protect next year's crop crop price and their income?
Well, I think we've been talking a lot about it. So as you look at swine, as you look at crops, if we look at some of the dairy, especially in Wisconsin, we're especially interested in making sure our clients are well aware of their options with FSA, very carefully evaluating the program options that they have there. On the dairy side, making sure that we're focused very closely on feed prices, what if you have land and you're able to provide that feed, you're at a real significant advantage on the dairy side. So I think it's more just working with your financial officer. Our job is to customize to your farm to make sure that we understand your goals and objectives and make sure they're met. Very difficult to provide a cookie cutter perspective to you right now about what we should do, I think, without looking very carefully at some of the goals and objectives of the farm and where you are in your stage of life, what you want to accomplish, how much land is owned, how much isn't owned. And on the input side, whether you own land or whether you don't, in terms of feed and other inputs as well, I think are very important. Make sure that we're pricing those as well ahead as we possibly can. I just think it's so variable. Talk to your FO, your farm financial officer, to make sure that your operation's understood as well as it can be. That's where we start.
The 2023 Farm Bill is not very far away. In fact, discussions are now in full swing, or at least beginning to be in full swing. What are the points of interest for the farm credit system?
Well, I think for us, we're always trying to represent our clients. And of course, safety net's everything. In a volatile market, especially now, got to make sure that they're there. They are there. I think the big question mark now becomes, with the House flipping to Republicans and with the Senate, with the Democrats and slim majorities in both houses, it's going to be tight. It's going to be a big debate. And I think the thing that we want to make sure is that I think the most important thing is, you'll hear people say, we would need to get the nutrition title separated out from the commodity title. I would disagree with them. I've been at this game for 37 years. And you got to keep those two together to pass a farm bill. So the question then becomes, is everybody willing to support a $1.3 trillion farm bill, of which 85% of its nutrition title? We don't talk about that very much in ag. But it's really the key to the farm bill entirely. So if you can get that funded, if you can get it agreed to, that's the key to starting the conversation on the commodity title. And then we start talking about the climate provisions, for example. Those are going to be areas of debate between the Senate and the House. There's going to be different perspectives. Can they compromise on that? They're going to have to now. And so my money's on probably some kind of an extension, maybe a one-year extension. That's fine. That's fine for our clients. And then I think it's whether longer term they're going to extend out what we currently have or transform what we have. My money's on an extension longer term. I just think that's probably what will happen. I think it'll be hard to negotiate something that's transformed from where it is with divided chambers. I just think that'll be – and have the president sign it. So I think extension's okay for our clients ultimately, and there may be some – added incentives in the program, safety nets. We'll have to wait and see how that turns out. But it's a really tough one to predict, I'll be honest with you.
You talked a bit about other things that happen within the farm bill, the nutrition side, for instance, the largest part of the farm bill. Generally not titled the farm bill, by the way, but we always call it that. That brings me to some other things in rural America that Compeer Financial is involved in, lending to others beyond farmers. For instance, I believe you have interest in housing and some other things that help to support rural communities.
Yeah, for towns under 2,500, we're able to finance rural houses, single family houses out there. So that's something we do across all our territory. Another thing we do is we invest in a lot of rural health care in rural communities across many states. The reason that we do that is because it's aging. A lot of the nursing homes and assisted living is kind of on the newer end of that elderly healthcare, and a lot of rural hospitals are old and aged. We view that as infrastructure, and so investing in them, that's critical. So something Compeer does, not many in the farm credit system do it. In fact, we're really the only ones that do it. And the reason that we do that is because we work with local banks to get it done, because the needs are so great. And we do it in many other states as well. And we're going to stay focused on that. But there's a lot of other needs in rural communities that we're going to focus on in 2023 to try to understand better. There's a lot of challenges, a lot of opportunities, a lot of innovations in these small towns. You'd be surprised to see QR codes that share workforce between restaurants. That's cool. And there's a whole bunch of other stuff that other communities do. So we're going to take a look at those things, see how we can invest and help make those communities even better.
Anything else before I let you go?
Good. We're good.
Thank you very much, John.
You bet, Todd. Thanks.
John Munson is with Compeer Financial. Well, we're here at National Association of Farm Broadcasting. Bill York joins us. He's with Farm Op Capital. And we're going to talk a little bit about operating loans at this time. It's that time of year when farmers are thinking about, well, I've got crop in the bin, but I've got one that I have to pay for next year. How am I going to do that? And many of them do that with what homeowners would think of as kind of a bridge loan, but it's called an operating loan. FarmOp is into this in a unique way, I know. Can you tell me a little bit about it, Bill?
Sure. FarmOp Capital lends based on the loan it's or the crop itself. So we're looking at the farmer's capability to produce a crop. We're looking at their crop insurance, and we're looking at their marketing strategy. So we're not tying up the other assets of the farm, and we're lending on that crop. And we believe it's very important to have the flexibility to optimize their operation. And that's why we believe it's important to have an operating loan in place early on. Most of our farmers have a current 23 operating loan. That allows them to be more efficient in purchasing their inputs, puts them in a better position to negotiate for rents, and allows them to plan their operation going forward. The other feature of our loan is we run it for up to 24 months so that we're not artificially forcing them to market before optimum times. We have over-operating loans. So each crop year stands, each crop stands on its own. So it allows them to buy early, market efficiently, and make the best decisions for their farm. And since we're lending on the value of the crop, if something changes with the crop, most of our farmers will add value in their crop from the time from the fall to the crops in the ground. They rented additional land. They decided to change their cropping plan from beans to corn or something like that. So we have a very efficient process to expand the size of their loan, with the idea of allowing the farmer to make the best decisions for their operation.
Again, let's talk about how you secure these loans, the collateral for the loans, because they are tied to the crop and some of the aspects that are available to be used for the crop, for instance, crop insurance. Can you tell me how that works?
Yeah, the security for our loans is the crop itself. So we have a lien on the crop. We do have an assignment of the crop insurance. And we do work with their CTA or their broker in terms of the marketing strategy. So that's what we're lending on. We're not, you know, tying up real estate or other assets to make these loans.
How safe is that from your perspective?
We found it to be, we're in our fifth crop year. We've had no credit losses over that time span. So we feel very good about the structuring of the product. And it allows us to bring in another source, a very robust source of capital into agriculture. We're being funded through significant Wall Street players, and gives us the flexibility to provide different interest rate products from variable SOFR-based to fixed rate products.
If people want to learn more about this, where do they go?
The best thing to do is to go to farmop.com, and we will contact you. We've got a field sales force that will reach out to you and begin a conversation.
And when do they need to be thinking about this? This time of year, later in the season?
Ideally, we'd like to have conversations beginning before they start harvest for the previous year. So now is the time to have those conversations moving forward.
Where did the idea come from, and how was it developed?
Yeah, actually, I've been involved with ag lending for a long time. I was the CEO of Agribank, which is the funding bank for the farm credit system in the middle of the country. And I chaired the risk management committee for the entire farm credit system. So I helped set credit policy. And throughout my career, I've seen a challenge for a traditional lender to provide adequate funding for operations that rent a significant part of amount of their land. They don't have the traditional balance sheet. And as you know, that segment is the fastest growing segment. It's the majority of operators, certainly in row crops. And so there was a gap there that we're trying to fill. And we've been very excited about filling that gap, and very excited about partnering with existing banks and the farm credit system to get that done.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Bill York is with FarmOp Capital. You can find them online at FarmOp, that's FarmOP.com.
You've been been listening to Commodity Week from Illinois Public Media. Find it online at willag.org. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.